I want you to take your Bibles now and turn to the book of Numbers. Come back to Numbers chapter 22. Numbers chapter 22. The two things that Paul deals with that are in saving faith, and when God looks at it, he says, that is what thrills me to be able to give you my righteousness. One is, Of course, in the gospel that he gives is the death, burial, and resurrection of Christ. I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about what is it in faith that makes that so God will exchange his righteousness for it. One is the absolute power that God has something to do for you that no one else can do, but the other is the certainty of his counsel to do it. And when he sees that, it just thrills him to be able to give you his righteousness for that faith. And this is the Bible's analysis of what saving faith is. Not some man's or some Greek professor from some stupid seminary, but what real saving faith is. It believes, it perceives God as one who quickens the dead and calleth those things which be not as though they were. But that issue of calling something that be not as though it is, that issue of what is it that makes God's counsel certain? What is it that makes his truth certain? Absolute, so that it is perfect in quality, perfect in degree. This is going to be expressed by an unbeliever, and God's going to express it through an unbeliever of what that is all about. That's why I've taken you back here to the book of Numbers. And I want you to come back here for a moment, and I want us to see something that is sitting back here in an account. After all, God is, he's proving this with a man who was under, with Abraham, who was back in God's time past program. And let me just go through that real quickly so that we're kind of all on the same page. Everybody likes charts, and I'm a visual kind of guy myself, and I like them too. Let me again just give you a real quick, this is the McDoctrine version of the timeline chart that I use. You may see one, there's other pastors that use them. There are some things that are very much in common with all of them, but this is the one that I use. And the one that I use begins, of course, where everything should begin, with creation. Now, that particular issue right there is an issue with a lot of Christians, because even Christians believe in Darwinian evolution. There's a lot of Christians that believe in evolution. You're not looking at one. I do not. I will not give the scientists the one thing that they want. Time. That's what the scientists want. I am not going to have a guy in a white coat tell me how much time I have. I'm going to let God tell me that. And so when God created the heavens and the earth, he created them just as it says he did in the book of Genesis, in the Genesis account. But something happened on that first day of creation that God did on this earth that a character was watching and saw that very thing happen. When the earth was without form and void, and when it was in its watered state, God was able to put something in that water that were actually going to be footings, that were going to be the place in which he was going to bring his own residence down and establish it on this earth. And we know that because the psalmist tells us that when he created this, when it was still water, he laid the beams for his chambers in the waters. And when he did that, he laid footings. Some of you guys in here are contractors. You know what a footing is. He lays the footings for the heavenly city, the New Jerusalem, that is going to come down and fit perfectly, where God is going to have his abode in Eden, in a place where God is going to be the resident on this earth and reign on this earth. Before and when the creation week transpires, day one, day two, day three, day four, day five, day six, man's created there on day six. On day seven, the first Sabbath, God rests from his work and establishes the Sabbath rest. Later on in Israel's program, it's revealed that in a particular feast that Israel was to have on her calendar, God did something very peculiar and unique to the end of the Feast of Tabernacles. On their calendar, there was a celebration on day one, which was to be a Sabbath day, and a celebration was to take place to commemorate what God originally was going to do on day 8, which would put you to the second Sabbath after the first. And my understanding is that on the second Sabbath, or the second Saturday of creation, it was God's desire and attempt to establish His kingdom here on this earth. That's why I have that right there. But there was a character that understood what was going on and was contending with God himself for God's position. He was a powerful angel by the name of Hallel, the light bearer. Did you ever wonder why God had light on day 1 but then has to create light again on day 4? Sun, moon, stars? Somebody who was bearing the light isn't bearing it anymore. You don't have to have the sun to have light. That's proven by being in here. We're in here at night and we can have light and no sun. But when God establishes Israel's program, He commemorates in their calendar what His original design was to possess this earth. When the adversary, which is what I like, the word Satan, Satanos in the Greek, means an adversary. Satan is not your enemy, is not merely your enemy. An enemy can leave you alone. I have a lot of enemies. And I believe a man is known just as well by his friends as by his enemies. And an enemy, though, can be an enemy distant and just forget you and ignore you and leave you alone. But an adversary, which is what the word Satan means, is someone who is actively trying to possess something that you have. That's why he is God's adversary. And that's why the adversary, when he strikes in two realms. One is on this earth. The other is in the heavenly places. And when he strikes, he usurps the authority in those places and takes that authority away from the ones who had it. And when Satan struck in the heavenly places, heaven is not, it's not clouds and floating around and kind of invisible. It's a real place with real places that mirror this earth. There's a place in the heavenly places called Persia. There's a place on this earth known as Persia. There's a prince of Persia in the heavenly places that kept Gabriel from coming down to Daniel for 2 weeks. Michael, the archangel, had to come down and get him out of customs or something. I don't know what it was, but he had to get him out of there so he could get down here. What I'm saying is there is a real heavenly governmental structure that the adversary was able to usurp. And he takes dominion over that. Not possession, but he takes dominion. It's like renting a house. You can possess it, but you don't have ownership. There was one man who was created to be the monarch of this earth, a human being, until God comes and establishes himself, Adam. I heard a guy say just this morning that Solomon was the richest man who ever lived. Adam owned the whole thing. He had all the oil under the earth, all the mineral rights. He had every gem, every stone. I can't think of anybody who was more wealthy than Adam was. He may not have lived in the Biltmore estate, but who needs it when you've got Eden? You can keep the Biltmore. I'll take Eden over that any day. So on day after day 6, before that second Sabbath could occur, he strikes. And that's the Genesis 3 account where you get the fall of mankind. Once Satan has now successfully taken possession of the heavenly places and the earth, the moment that happened, watch what happens to God's kingdom. That thing gets completely delayed now. It's put on hold. There's going to be an entire process that's going to take place before that's going to get established. But that still, when that happens, is going to be the second Sabbath after the first in God's thinking. There's just a delay of it now. All right? So let's put some things on here that we can orient to. The flood takes place and God has to destroy the earth by flood except for 8 people who were righteous in their generations. That was Noah, his wife, their 3 sons, and their wives. God promises something to Noah there that's very critical for the person he's going to begin utilizing. But something very important happens before Abraham comes onto the scene at the Tower of Babel. And at the Tower of Babel, the adversary does something there that causes God to take the nations and confound their language. He doesn't confuse their tongues. God isn't the author of confusion. Confuse and confound are 2 different things. He confounds their languages, and then we have the beginning of national entities. These will come to be known as Gentile nations, and due to the nature of them, listen, the very first law that God gives to Moses has to do with the issue of having no other God before thee. That issue in the Gentiles was totally destroyed in their thinking. They were unfit and unusable for God's purpose, plan, and design. And the Gentiles become what will be called later the uncircumcised. God will call them far off. Paul will call them without God in the world. In fact, that's why Paul comes along and says, you as a Gentile are twice dead. You're a twice dead Gentile. You were dead in your trespasses and sin, he says in Colossians, and in the uncircumcision of your flesh. You are totally unfit. No one could be you. But you remember what I said about Noah? God had made a promise concerning someone in the line of Shem. And therefore, God could take one man and begin to create a national entity that had never existed on earth before. And out of those Ebriites, the Hebrews, he chooses Abraham. And Abraham is the beginning of what will come to be known as the nation of Israel, the circumcised. Those who are nigh unto God. God has a purpose, a plan, and design. Now, this is where we start thinking about what faith is in Romans. God has a purpose. He has a counsel with what he is going to do with the nation of Israel. And it has to do with this earth. Israel is earthly. Earth, earth, earth. They look down. They don't look up. They look down. But anyway. Israel has to do with the establishment of God's kingdom on this earth. Abraham looked for a city whose builder and maker was God. He was looking for a city to be established on this earth. You know what's interesting? When Moses was born, it's interesting when you go over to the book of Acts and you see Stephen describing Moses, he calls him a proper child. I'm not saying that's a wrong translation. It is a right translation. But the root of that Greek word that he uses, you know what that word means? It's the word polos. I came from a state whose capital city was Indianapolis. That word means city. Moses was a city boy, a city child. He was another one in that line that's looking for that city, anticipating when God's kingdom is going to be established with that new city, Jerusalem, on this earth. Then comes along that guy I've been talking about, Moses. And Moses does something very fantastic, actually. Moses is probably the greatest leader of all of human history. Moses could lead not only militarily, but he could lead politically as well. He was also a musical genius. And that's not bad, boy, when you've got all that going for you. He wasn't much of a speaker. And he had the greatest signs. I loved his hand, the thing he did with his hand. That's the one I'd like. You know, if God was going to give signs, miracles, and wonders today, that's the one I'd want. Because I'd just once like to go up to somebody and say, you know, here's the way the word of God should rightly be divided. You don't believe me? Watch this. Leprosy. Now it's clean. Leprosy. Clean. I know, I'm just kidding. But Moses could take the city of New York, and you could unleash every criminally insane person in every prison in New York City, open all the jails as well as all the right-thinking people. Moses could lead them. He was a fantastic leader. And through the first 18 chapters of the book of Exodus, especially chapters 15, when they come out of the Red Sea and they cross over the actual opening to the pit. A fantastic doctrine. The major opening to the pit that goes down to hell is in the Red Sea. And Moses took the children of Israel across there. God congealed it and they crossed over, wounding Leviathan in that sea. It tells you later in the Bible, when the children of Israel crossed the Red Sea, Leviathan, Satan himself, who took up residence there, was wounded. Satan is always interested in residing in waters. If you took a look at the map of Israel today, there is water surrounding Israel. That's for a reason. When Jesus Christ comes back in his flight path, he is going to destroy the waters. He's going to obliterate the Red Sea. He's going to open the opening to the pit. And it causes the prophet to come along and say, When you look at Haggai chapter 3, which is the flight path the Lord takes in his return path, he says, were you angry against the waters? What is it about the water? He is destroying the strongholds of Satan's power. When they cross that Red Sea, they sing a song, and Moses takes them through five courses of education in God's Jehovahness and grace. And those five courses of their education is so important because they're going to come to a time where they're going to have to decide whether they're going to stick with God's Jehovahness and grace, or they're going to have to produce it themselves. And when it came that time, God says, you've seen how I've bore you on eagle's wings, all of these things, make your choice. And when they make their choice, they say, everything that you say we will do. There's Exodus, that's the law. And God's whole demeanor changes. Do you ever notice how wonderful God is and how loving and how gracious and how patient he is and all of these kinds of things as you go through the children of Israel's history from the time they come out of the Red Sea until Mount Sinai, and as soon as they claim, everything that you say, we will do. You give us the law. We'll produce our own righteousness. You just give your law to us. The moment they do that, the moment they enter into that contract with God, his entire demeanor changes. You want to deal with me based upon my raw righteousness? You so much as touch this mountain and I'll kill you. You so much as I have a hamster wander onto it, I'll kill it. His whole demeanor changes. And so therefore, in that law contract, they're told by Moses, you're not going to be able to keep this. In fact, they were told that in one of the trials they went through before the law was ever given. All God gave them were laws concerning manna. And he gave them two things to do. Only gather as much as you can eat in one day. And on Friday, gather double. Because you're not going to gather on the Sabbath. How hard can that be? What did they do? They tried to gather more for one day, and what they had went to the worms. And then they go around, they didn't gather enough on the day before the Sabbath, they go around on the Sabbath wondering, well, where's all our manna? They screwed up with just two. You know what God gives them? He didn't give them 10. He winds up giving them 613 laws when they couldn't keep two. They get 10, the Ten Commandments, then they get through the book of Leviticus, they get the rest of the law contract, and then what happens is in the book of Deuteronomy, Moses comes along and just before he dies, he gives them the whole thing again. The Deuteronomy is the second giving of that law. But one of the most important chapters you will ever, 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 ever get straight in the Bible is the 26th chapter of Leviticus. In that chapter, Israel is told, if you break this law contract, you're going to incur five courses of punishment. And they're not cycles, they're courses. When one begins, it runs the whole way. Actually, it runs all the way here. When the second one begins, it runs all the way. When the third one, all the way. When the fourth one, and when the fifth one. And so by the time the fifth one hits right here, hey, that looks like music, doesn't it? By the time... By the time the fifth one hits, all the other four are still running. That's why they're not cycles. A cycle begins and ends, begins and ends, begins and ends. When the first course of punishment begins, and what's interesting, we don't have time to do this right now, but the Bible will tell you when each one of those begins. For instance, in the third one, where Elijah is concerned, they were to know that when they saw their children eaten by wild animals, they were in the third course of their punishment. And some children came out and started making fun of Elijah's bald head. And she-bears came out and ate the children. That tells you you're in the third course of punishment. That's the accuracy that each one of these has. The fifth course of punishment, when they began here, they begin the times of the Gentiles. And there are five installments to that last course of punishment. And all the prophets go through all those five installments. The way the prophets from Isaiah through Malachi are to be understood is that they may deal with all of these, but as you open a prophetic book like Isaiah, the first part of it's going to deal primarily with this first installment, and the last part of the book is going to deal primarily with this last installment. There's five installments. They're all given in one verse in Ezekiel 21:27, when he says, I'm going to take the diadem, I'm going to take the crown, and I'm going to cast it down. As soon as you go under a Gentile domination, I'm going to take your crown off and throw it down. And no one is going to legitimately sit on that throne until Jesus Christ sits on that throne, the throne of David. And he says, I will overturn. Then he will come, whose right it is, and I will give it him. Watch this. I will overturn. Then he will come. Fourth installment. There is the life and ministry of Jesus Christ. He will come, whose right it is. Then, after this fifth course, I will give it him, the kingdom right there. All five installments in one verse. Anyway, when Jesus Christ came to this earth, one of the things that he was able to do is to put into effect the mechanical means by which God is going to, from all the way back here, establish his kingdom on this earth. And there are five major mandates of the mechanical way in which he's going to do it. He had told Israel he's going to do it, but until David came along, then he gave the details. And to David he said, I'm going to enflesh myself in your line. He said it this way, I will make thee an house. And the mechanical means by which he is going to actually accomplish what he's going to do to repossess this earth from Satan, from the adversary, is through the five mandates of that Davidic covenant. He's got to function here first and foremost as the Redeemer. That's why you get the book of Ruth. That's why it's where it is in the Bible. That tells you what a Redeemer is all about, a kinsman Redeemer. He is our kinsman. He is also our substitute, our all-sufficient Redeemer. And all these other mandates are sitting on the functioning of this one. They all must function after that one is functioned. By the way, that's why the next one is going to be in the Lord's Day of Wrath. Here is the climactic stage. And in the Lord's Day of Wrath, Christ is going to come back and function as the Deliverer. And that's why you have that fantastic change in terminology in the book of Isaiah. The prophet talks about him functioning as thy Redeemer. Paul comes along and he says, thy Deliverer. He changes it. Paul knows the Redeemer has already happened. The next thing on the agenda is to function as the Deliverer and then the Avenger. By the way, in the book of Judges, they're introduced to that concept with two basic judges. There was one judge by the name of Gideon, and Gideon was told by God, you will be my what? My deliverer. Gideon is a picture of Jesus Christ functioning as the deliverer, and he's going to provide salvations, plural, for the remnant of Israel as they function during what we know as the tribulation. T-R. Oh, for crying out loud. Well, anyway. The tribulation period. I'll get it if it kills me. Crib. That's all I wanted to write. You'd think. These two are going to be very important. They provide salvations for the remnant of Israel during that tribulation period. You can read all about them in the book of Revelation. He's also going to function as that avenger. There was another judge who was given to the nation of Israel back in the book of Judges by the name of Samson, and he was called the Avenger of Israel. Then, after Christ functions as the Deliverer and Avenger, he is going to come back, and he is going to be the King and the Blesser. And so they need, these are the things that God, that Israel must have, that God must provide by his Jehovahness and grace. They need a Redeemer in his redemption. They need a Deliverer in his deliverance. They need an Avenger in his avengement. They need a King and his kingdom. And they need a Blesser and his blessings. By the way, if you take the book of Psalms, and you have a Bible that divides the book of Psalms into five divisions, Psalms, the first book of Psalms, all deals with the Redeemer and his redemption. The second book of Psalms deals with the Deliverer and his deliverance. The third book, the Avenger. The fourth book, the King. And the fifth book of Psalms deals with the blessings. That's why the book of Psalms is divided in the way it is, in that order, that exact order. It's a fascinating issue of the way your Bible is made. Now, where are you on this chart? You're not here. What is this design? What is the counsel of this chart? To repossess the earth. What is it that you're told in 99.999% of churches today? You sing it in your hymns. We're all going to come back with Jesus. And I hope that you like riding horses, because we're going to ride on horses and we're going to come back with Jesus to take the kingdom and establish the kingdom on this earth, right? That's what you're taught. That's what a good denominational church will teach you. You know why? Because they were taught that stuff in seminary. You're not on this chart, and you're not doing that. That's not your job. I'm not saying you're not going to be able to come down to this earth at all, but that's not what God's purpose for you is about. We could say that all that I have just charted on here is according to prophecy. Every single aspect of this has already been written down. Nothing new. God's program from the very beginning was revealing this. And the way God does it, put it in great big terms. And then start narrowing the focus and giving additional information and additional and more focused and more detail and more additional detail. And that's why the Bible goes from Genesis through the book of Malachi the way it does. And by the time you get to the end of the book of Malachi, you're right there, just prior to John the Baptist speaking. You've just come out of 400 years of silence. The majority of the fifth course of Israel's punishment is spent by God saying nothing to Israel. And by the way, it's right at that point where you're told in the Bible what God constitutes as something that is profane. Remember when Paul comes along and says, avoid profane and vain babblings? The Bible defines what profane is. It doesn't mean somebody used the word ass. We're going to be using that in the book of Numbers correctly. That's not what that means. You go back in the book of Jeremiah, there's an entire chapter in Jeremiah dedicated to telling you what profane is. Profane to God is somebody who says, God told me, when God didn't tell you anything. The three magic words today out of any Christian's mouth is those words. God told me. God told me to come over to you right now and give you this tract. God told me to knock on your door, violate your privacy, and invite you to my stupid church. You notice I never invited any of you here. I'm glad you're here. But when you walk out that door, I'm not following you around. I really could care less. That's your ambassadorship. I've got my own to worry about. And I'm not going to nose into your business. All of this is prophecy. And the idea is that when God comes along and says something, he says it, he gets it written down, challenges to what he says is profane. There's a big challenge to what God has written going on right now. Have you heard of this thing called the Da Vinci prophecy or something like that? Code, the Da Vinci Code. That's a crock. But I'm sure they'll have all the doodads that'll come out with it, like the purpose-driven life. You'll have the Da Vinci Code coffee cup and the Da Vinci Code refrigerator magnet and Da Vinci Code wristwatch and keychains and all the doodads. It's as marketable as any Hollywood movie. Anyway, this is all according to when Christ shows up right here. How many people think that Jesus kind of just is some itinerant preacher that gets up every morning and just goes, I don't know, I think I'll go walk on water today. Good idea. I think I'll get these guys together, go up to this mountain, we'll talk, we'll rap a while. Let's sit and have a rap session. Call it the Sermon on the Mount. Everything Christ said and did is according to that prophecy. He did it in a particular order, in a particular way. And everything he said, he didn't just get up and have some fanciful idea. He did it according to the way in which Adam actually should have been doing it. God waked him up every morning. He went and had a Bible class before he ever ate. He satiated his soul first, then his body. He got the doctrine for that day. He operated upon that doctrine. And therefore, what he says and where he goes is according to a particular design. Heavens, if you pay attention to the last way in which Christ comes into Jerusalem for the last time, he's coming in from the Transjordan side, crossing over right there at Jericho, and then coming into Jerusalem. He's making a dry run of his own flight path when he comes back. It's fantastic. If you just pay attention to that. All of this was according to prophecy. Now, where do you fit in? Well, as I told you before, I don't know how well this is going to work. Well, yeah, I'll do it anyway. I'm going to have to... Well, let's try it. I'll push this down. As I said before, I've got a chart on this, but as I said before, the theater of war... The warfare for this earth and God establishing his kingdom is a theater of war. If you remember or you studied in World War II, the United States fought two theaters of war at the same time. We fought two simultaneous theaters, the Pacific Theater of War and the European Theater of War. My dad was a railroader who happened to have the unfortunate, be in the unfortunate position of right after VE Day was announced, he had men, he had soldiers, he was a conductor on troop trains and prisoner of war trains in the United States during the war. He had a trainload of nearly four-year combat veteran soldiers who had been over in the European theater, had come home, had been on furlough, and then were now being shipped out to California to go and fight whatever remained in the Pacific theater. These guys have already fought 4 years. And when he's taking them to St. Louis, some idiot on that train hears over the radio that VJ Day, they had just announced the surrender of right after Hiroshima and Nagasaki, they announced the surrender of Japan. Now, you've got to remember something. All the railroads were under governmental orders at that time. They were ordered to go places. They couldn't just go where they wanted to go. Now, all these guys, all these GIs, this brakeman tells these guys, hey, did you know that they said, turn this train around. We're not going out there. I'm going home. My dad said there wasn't a thing in the world I could do. I said, what did you do? He said, all we could do is stand back and watch. They tore every seat, every chair, every piece of furniture out of that train. They gutted those trains. By the time they pulled into the yards in St. Louis, there were just shells rocking back and forth full of guys having a party in there. So what do you expect me to do to guys that are seasoned combat veterans? I'm not going to tell them to sit down and shut up. And there was only like five on the crew, and how many hundreds of them? Now, the idea there is just that we were able to successfully wage war on two fronts at the same time. God does exactly that same thing. This earth is only one. You're not to resolve that part of the angelic conflict. There's another theater of war. And what God did was, he in prophecy constantly was talking about how he's going to take the adversary, destroy that adversary, destroy his plan and policy of evil, do all of these things to repossess this earth. But Satan could come along and say, fine, I'll concede the earth. You want it? Fine. I have the entire governmental structures of all the heavenly places. And you've never said one word about what you're going to do there. Not a word. In fact, there's a fantastic passage back in the prophets. It might even be in Job, where Satan actually gets near this. When he says, paraphrase, he says, you can't even keep a secret from me. Oh, I'd have been tempted. But he actually challenges him on that. You can't even keep a secret from me. What he does is what Paul says, takes that crafty one in his own craftiness. Without any previous knowledge whatsoever, beginning in Acts 9, God did something unexpected, unannounced, unprophesied about, unspoken of by him to anyone at any time for all generations. God had told Peter and the 12, when I come back, the next time you see me, how does the book of Acts open up? It opens up with them looking up into heaven as Jesus is ascending, and they hear the wonderful words, you men of Israel, why stand you gazing up into that? This same Jesus who has gone up from you will come back in like manner. He's going to come back, and when he finally touches earth, he's going to touch down at the Mount of Olives where that Holiday Inn is. I wouldn't want to be staying in there at that time, because it's going to split that thing open, and you don't want to be in that room at that time. Peter, James, John, and all the rest of the 12, including Matthias, understood perfectly. The next time I'm to visually see my Lord Jesus Christ is when he's standing on that Mount of Olives. All of a sudden, trucking up the road, comes somebody that says, hey, you know what? Up north of here in the town of Damascus, there is a Pharisee up there by the name of Saulus Paulus Benjamin Tarsus. Jesus came down and appeared to him. I say, he's got to be a liar. He's lying. He's got to be lying. Do you notice how often, how throughout all of Paul's letters he says, I lie not, I lie not, I lie not, I lie not. But this was not spoken. That's right. The last verse of the book, or the last few verses of the book of Romans tells you that Paul was given the mystery. And what God did in saving Paul and raising him up in Acts chapter 9 suspended his program with Israel. And what, not only is God going to win this earth back, he's going to win the heavenly places back. And not only that, he's going to do it even before he gets this earth. This just sticks it in the eye of the adversary. And that's what he's going to do in this dispensation of Gentile grace, this mystery dispensation. And that's why that's where you and I are. That's why he begins with one new man. That's why prophecy runs up to this point where this church age begins. And in fact, I don't even like using that expression. If somebody says, you believe in the church age? I believe in both of them. Which church are you talking about? The church which is Israel, the remnant of Israel, the little flock? Or are you talking about us, the church, the body of Christ? Notice prophecy out here. Everything that's going to happen out there in that Lord's day of wrath is also going to happen. Paul used terminology very simple to give us an understanding of this. He said everything from the beginning of from Acts 9, everything from the beginning of this dispensation of grace back, that's time past. By the way, this is going to change. Peter will talk about time past, but now to come. But it changes. You have to shift it over when the Lord's day of wrath begins. This is the but now. Paul calls this but now. This is the but now of this mystery dispensation of grace, where a new man is now being formed. Remember that passage in Corinthians that says, "Behold, all things are become new." That's a dispensational change that's being talked about there. That's not, I've got a new outlook on life. So how does the Bible look when you compare it, when you understand it in God's program, time past, but now, and to come? Well, it's real simple. Genesis through the opening chapters of the book of Acts is time past. That's Israel's program. And nothing brings this home like three simple words that Peter said on the day of Pentecost, when people were speaking in tongues and all the miracles were being done. And this is a challenge, by the way. I have a friend of mine who's trying to deal with a pastor about this. And in that particular section, Peter says, this is that. Three words. This is that. That's the passage, by the way, I'd never teach you. I wouldn't touch that with a 10-foot pole. Because I knew in my own thinking, somebody's lying here. Either Peter doesn't know what he's talking about, or Paul's lying. Because Paul says this part of it was never known to any man. Jesus never spoke of this. No prophet ever spoke of this. This was not known until it was given to me. Of what the mystery of this one new man called the body of Christ, what this body is going to do. All right? So we have a section of doctrine that's contained to you, for you, and about you. Don't ever let anybody... You see the... Look at the book that I have you open. See the book we're in? That's the book of Numbers. Where is that? That's time past. Don't ever let somebody tell you that we're ultra-dispensational and that we just rip the Old Testament out and throw it away. That's baloney. Most of the major problems that exist in most people's thinking is because they don't know Israel's program. And so you have, but that's not your mail. Our mail is Romans through Philemon. That is the mail God's written with your name on it. The entire Christian way of life is explained there. That's where we're going to find our marching orders. And then when the rapture of the church, you say, well, the rapture's not in the Bible. Okay, well, I'll use the Bible's terminology. It's a little awkward, but if you insist, the gathering up, the catching up. Catch it. I like catch it, by the way. I saw the other day, we used to have Heinz, and all of a sudden a bottle of Hunt's showed up. You think about that on the way home, you'll figure it out. When the rapture of this church takes place and God takes the body out, he's going to take us and seat us in those heavenly places, in the governmental structure up there. Then will happen, there's going to be three significant events that take place. A voice of an archangel, the shout, and a trumpet. The voice, the shout, the trumpet are all on this side of the rapture. These are issues that are all found in terminology in Israel's program that tells Israel now your history is going to be fulfilled. And that's why you get the books of Hebrews through Revelation. These are the books that the remnant of Israel, that little flock, is going to operate on out there during the Lord's day of wrath. And so therefore, what you actually have here, let me back this up. I think I can... technology going in my favor here. This is the chart that I use, all right? Now, all I've done with this particular chart is put all of the books of the Bible underneath it. And so that you can see where these books exist, all you've got to do is take this chart and say, well, if you're in the book of Ezra, for instance, here's the... Well, darn it. I always do that. You're in the book of Ezra, just comes straight up on the chart. Well, you're in the second installment of Israel's fifth course of punishment. Tells you right where you are on the timeline chart. I've got another one that has all the years on it too, which is gets a little muddy, but there's the one with even the years on it. So that's the chart that I use. And by the way, let me show you just one other thing. Here's what I was after. The two theaters of war. The purpose with which God is going to use you is to settle the government of the heavens. That's why Paul constantly is telling you to look up. Set your affections on the things that are above. Ours is, our warfare is not with flesh and blood. Israel's is. Israel, and I'm going to show you that right here in the book of Numbers. Israel has a conflict with flesh and blood. We don't. Ours is with principalities and powers and mights and dominions. Where? On this earth? No, in heavenly places. There is an entire heavenly governmental structure. This is what's not in that purpose-driven life. The purpose-driven life doesn't tell you what your purpose is for. Your special purpose. Your purpose is to be that body that Christ is going to be seated with Him as the head in the heavenly places. That means there were two Christmases. You realize that? Two Christmases. The one that we normally think of, the body that Christ was nailed to that cross with, but then there was another body that began there in Acts chapter 9, and what Satan now has to endure. And this is the beauty of having the Lord's table. What he has to endure now for year after year, for 4 years now, he has to endure watching that heavenly government slip away believer by believer by believer by believer. And what he thought was his ultimate victory is going to be, to his chagrin, his ruin and his end. And God's going to repossess the heavenly places from the adversary, and he's going to seat you there. And with your reward and decoration system, some of you are going to be seated in places higher than others. And you're going to administrate. That's why in the book of Corinthians he says, don't you know that you're going to judge angels? That doesn't mean you're going to be sitting in a row behind a bench saying that's in, that's out, that's safe, that's out, that's right, that's wrong. Judging there, krima, means to be administrating a governmental position of rulership. You're going to be governing angels. As a person who is a part of a body, a new man that's never existed on this earth before. And you have access to the greatest power that God has ever given and the greatest, most genius plan he has ever had. He saved it and revealed it to you. And then he's going to come back in that body that he was crucified with, that the nail prints are still in his hands and feet. And he looks like a battered war hero. And he's going to come back to this earth, and he's going to be seated in David's throne, so that if you look on this earth, Christ is reigning. If you look in the heavenlies, by the way, on this earth, Christ is reigning in a body. In the heavenly places, Christ is also reigning in a body. All of us. And that will bring in and set the stage for the last dispensation, called the fullness of times, in which he will, of course, come and he will bring all things in heaven and earth under the imperial headship of Christ. All right, let me get back to the timeline chart. Well, this is the one that I make it go away. That one will do just fine. There's my explanation of my timeline chart. All right. Let's come to the book of Numbers. When you're in the book of Numbers, look on the chart. You're right here. Come straight up here. Bam. You're right in the time in which the law has been given. Let me set the stage for you before we get to this fantastic passage. What I'd like for you to do, by the way, if you want homework, read chapter. There's four chapters that we're going to be interested in. Chapters 22, 23, 24, and 25. And there's something in these chapters that no Bible corrector would ever touch with a 10-foot pole. But what you're going to get here is an interlude. There's four chapters dedicated to these characters called Balak and Balaam. Why would God, not only he's going to interrupt and put a little interlude in here about these guys, but why give them four whole chapters? There's got to be something really important about this, and there is. The tremendous importance of the history and the prophetic future of the nation of Israel is seen in that God dedicates all four chapters of his word from 22 through 25 of Numbers to issues surrounding these two chapters. It's repeatedly, by the way, brought up to the attention of the members of the remnant of Israel. Over here, when the remnant of Israel begins functioning out here in the Lord's day of wrath, they're going to take the book of Hebrews and begin with that, and they're going to get oriented. By the way, the book of Hebrews begins where Stephen left off. The very scriptures that Stephen quotes when Stephen is stoned to death and murdered is where the Hebrews picks up, and miracles are seen again. And Hebrews takes up exactly what Romans does for us. Romans is the foundational, edifying, orienting book for you and I. Hebrews is the foundational orientation for the remnant of Israel to get back with God's resumption of his program with Israel and the fulfillment of it. And then James, 1st, 2nd Peter, 1st, 2nd, 3rd John, Jude, and Revelation. Revelation is the daily newspaper so that they can read the daily events of what's going to happen out there. By the way, you're not in the book of Revelation either. But anyway, this is so important that Peter will come along in 2 Peter and he will talk about Balaam and he will warn the remnant about the way of Balaam. Jude will come along and Jude will warn the remnant of Israel about the error of Balaam. And John will come along in the book of the Revelation and in the second chapter he's going to warn them about the doctrine of Balaam. So I'd say it's a pretty important issue. If God not only gives four chapters to it in the book of Numbers, but then gives three warnings of it in these books to the remnant of Israel, we better know what's going on here. In fact, a statement is going to be made by Balaam that is the absolute quintessential explanation of what it is in God's truth that makes it absolute. What it is in God's counsel that makes it certain. All of this stuff that God's going to do through here and on to here is his counsel with Israel. How do they know he's going to do it? That's what this incident is going to do, this Balaam-Balak incident. Come back to the first chapter. Hold your place here. I'm about out of time. I'm having to figure out what I want to do here to end this up. I want you to see, let's just try and set in our thinking the background or when this occurs. Come to the first chapter of Numbers, chapter 1, verse 1. By the way, I know the old joke. You notice that in our church we don't count how many people are here. We don't have a scoreboard up here with lights on it. So many people in Sunday school and all this business. That's not the way a grace operation functions for one thing, but I had somebody once come up to me and say, well, you know God does have a book in the Bible called Numbers. You just want to slap people. Well, God isn't numbering the church, the body of Christ. He's numbered the children of Israel. And not only that, but I want to show you why he numbered them. Numbers chapter 1, verse 1, and the Lord spake unto Moses in the wilderness of Sinai. Remember, is in this little, very, 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 very sketchy, full of holes, brief, sweeping history I just gave you. Where you're at on the chart is actually right about here. I'm going to put a squiggly line up here. That's the Jordan River. Here's the Sea of Galilee up here. Dead Sea down here. That's the Jordan River. Right here is where they are. And they're right here on the edge of the Jordan. This is in chapter 22. Jericho is right about there. Keep that in mind. Come back to the first chapter, and we're going to back up about 40 years. Watch this. The Lord spake unto Moses in the wilderness of Sinai in the tabernacle of the congregation on the first day of the second month in the second year after they were come out of the land of Egypt. So we're only 2 years after the Red Sea crossing, okay? That's how this book opens up. And you know the story. You probably heard it in Sunday school. You know, the spies go out and they do all this. They go, they come up to the land, to Kadesh Barnea. They come up to the land, and it could have been a straight shot up there. By the way, there's a reason why they didn't go in a straight line from Sinai to the Promised Land. They went in a kind of a zigzag. Looks like it's haphazard. Get that out of your thing. There is no random haphazardness in your Bible. They go, God takes Israel to battlefields. Each one of those places they go to is a battle he is going to wage when he comes back. In his flight path, he's going to make aerial bombardments of these places when he comes back. We went over that when we studied the flight path. But anyway, they go up there. Moses says, go check it out. Send the spies in. Out of all of them, there's only two came back with a positive report, right? Caleb and Joshua. But look at what God tells Moses to do here. Verse 2, take ye the sum of the congregation of the children of Israel after their families by the house of their fathers with a number of their names, every male by their polls, from 20 years old and upward, all that are able to go forth to war in Israel, thou and Aaron shall number them, watch this at the end, by their armies. See that? What are they getting ready for? War. A battle is going to take place. A battle for that land. By the way, that's why that land has pockets of water all the way around it. That's why the adversary sees that land. By the way, that's why Israel is the only land on earth that can be defiled. Because that's where God's abode is going to be. It's holy. It's sanctified. You can't say that even about Gettysburg, as sacred as that land is there in Pennsylvania. Or Arlington Cemetery. As sacred as that land is, the land of Israel is land that could be defiled by the adversary. That's why you're constantly told when Abraham is being dealt with, and the Canaanite is there, and the Canaanite was there, and the Canaanite was there. The adversary is fortifying that land and defiling it. By the way, there was disease there because of bestiality. And this is why when God was going to wipe them out, he was going to wipe them out, men, women, children, and animals. It's because of the nature of what that land meant and was in the adversary's design to destroy the nation of Israel. So they're going to go to battle. Now, you know the story. As the book of Numbers goes on, they go up there, they see the land, they see all that's there, and they come back and they have a negative report, save two men. So what God does, he spends 40 years taking them through the wilderness, killing off or letting that first generation die off. And once that generation dies off, come to Numbers chapter 22 now, we're back again. After 40 years, we come up the Transjordanian side and we're right there. Moses now, he can't go over. Moses knows that because of something he did. He's going to have to die without going into the Promised Land, but he'll be able to see it. So in the book of Numbers, they're right now ready to cross the Jordan River and take the land and start conquering it. So God says, hold off for a minute. Let's pause here for a moment. And I'm going to insert this issue of Balaam and Balak to give Israel a dress rehearsal for what's going to happen in this day when, as Jesus said, when they rejected him, there will come another in his own name, and him ye will receive. There is a Gentile king who is going to pose as Israel's own king. Balak is a Gentile king. This king out here is going to have a prophet who is also, like himself, an Assyrian. Balaam is a prophet from Assyria. And what I want to do is, we're out of time, I'm going to have to stop here. On Tuesday night, actually I didn't get to anything really. I didn't say anything today. And yet my mouth is so dry. There's a whole cast of characters here I want you to see. There's this character Balak. Look at verse 1 of chapter 22. And the children of Israel set forward and pitched in the plains of Moab on this side Jordan by Jericho. They're just across the water, across from Jericho. Jericho is where God was going to place the 12 stones that is going to be the very marker by which the Lord, when he enters in, back into the land, he crosses over and he fulfills the true Joshua. Verse 2, and Balak, the son of Zippor, saw all that Israel had done to the Amorites. And Moab was sore afraid of the people because they were many. And Moab was distressed because of the children of Israel. And Moab said unto the elders of Midian, now shall this company lick up all that is around us, as the ox licketh up the grass of the field. And Balak the son of Zippor was king of the Moabites at that time. And he sent messengers therefore unto Balaam the son of Beor to Pethor, which is by the river of the land of the children of his people, to call him, saying, behold, there is a people come out of Egypt. Behold, they cover the face of the earth, and they abide over against me. Now stop right there. This is the actual threatening of the adversary owns the land. You ever hear, and I'm using the word own in a military sense. When you hear the United States military say, you hear a soldier say on a news report right now, we own the night in Iraq. What they mean by that is, we see everything, we hear everything, we are the king of the hill when it comes to that issue. Satan owned that land. He had it fortified. Now, Israel is sitting right outside, and they've been numbered according to their armies. They're getting ready to go to war. The battle's starting. Balak understands that. Balak understands exactly what's being threatened here. These people coming out of Egypt, they're going to lick this land up. They're going to lick us, and lick us good. And so what he's going to do is, he is going to do something, and I'll stop right here, because I have to. I got to. He is going to form, for the first time in human history, a confederacy of nations. He's going to attempt to bring a, you know what we call that today, by the way? A coalition. Now, they've had battles already with Og of Bashan. They've had other battles and skirmishes. But this is the first time that an attempt is going to be made to bring a coalition or a confederate of nations together to fight against Israel. It's going to be quickly dealt with, but it's a preview of coming attractions when this man of sin out here actually does it. And by the way, I can show you all 10 nations of that confederacy. They're in the 83rd Psalm. And there isn't a European nation among them. I'm not saying the European nations won't be involved in attacking Israel, but the confederacy is not European. So stop getting excited. Everybody talks about the 10-nation confederacy in the European common market. That's not biblical. This happening here has already been previewed back here. Beginning on Tuesday night, I'm going to show you that preview. There's four messages Balaam gives, actually three plus one, and in the second one, sitting right in the middle of it all, God's going to explain why he should be believed, why his counsel is certain, and what it is that sets the absolute certainty of his counsel apart from human truth. And I'll show you that beginning Tuesday night. With our heads bowed, with